I'm Trisha Helfer, and you are listening to After the Credits at row3.com.
Welcome to today's show. I'm your host, Marina, and with me today
is Dale.
Colleen.
I thought I'd like change it up a little bit without telling you, sorry. Yeah, welcome to another show, episode number 4. We're moving along strongly. I love it. Lots of stuff to talk to today, but before we get started, just a quick announcement that the latest installment of the Movie Club podcast, number 3, just went live. So if you haven't checked it out, please do. We watched and discussed at great length Escape from New York and The Last Man on Earth. So go on over. There's a link to the new show from Row 3, or you can just visit movieclubpodcast.com for all your info and to download the show. So we're going to jump right in because there's lots of stuff to talk about today. And we're going to start with one from last week that's currently playing in various cities throughout Canada. I don't think it's opened in the States, but and it is Walk All Over Me, starring Trisha Helfer and Lily Sobieski.
Awesome.
Unfortunately, I didn't get to see it yet. I'm counting on you guys to set me straight.
Yeah, well, I still can't believe you passed up seeing Trisha Helfer in person.
That was like, yes, the gods were not kind to me that day.
Yeah, the stars weren't aligned correctly or anything. I know. I really liked the movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. I think it helped the fact that it was a full house, like full house. So it really, people were excited and having a good time, and there was a fair bit of cheering and laughing and clapping, so.
Yeah, it was surprisingly good. It was better than I thought it was going to be. Like,
yeah,
sometimes you hear about these films, and you have someone vaguely famous in a small film kind of thing, and yeah, it's usually crap.
Now, of course,
but
our loyal listeners will have already heard the Q&A.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I mean, it's interesting that we say, you know, somebody famous, but when you think about it, Lily Sobieski is really the headliner of this movie because she is the big star in this movie, if you were to pick one of the group of people that star in the film. But I mean, being a local Vancouver crowd with BSG being so popular around here, and there were a lot of BSG fans in the audience.
Oh, there to see number 6.
And how did Trisha do? Because I have to say, and I think I've said this before, but when she first came on the scene in BSG, I was like, you know, another model trying to. But to me, she's really proven her acting chops. So this movie, I still want to see this movie just to see how her acting is.
You know, my favorite scene with Trisha Helford specifically is when she gets home and the one guy's there and she's dressed like a cop and like proceeds to beat the snot out of someone. It was just quality.
Yeah, she.
It was really a feel good moment.
It was, and I mean,
but
she,
that's not a stretch from BSG.
No,
well, no, and I mean, when you really think about it, the character is sort of an extension of Number 6 to an extent, but I think she does really bring a more. I don't want to say human because that's so cliche, but she does have the soft moments where she does play the sort of kind of damsel in distress, but she's not your typical damsel in distress. Like, she doesn't come off all, oh my God, I can't help myself. Somebody come and save me and protect me.
Well, you know, the thing that was nice is like, yeah, Lily Sobieski or something like that.
Yeah.
And Trisha Helfer were the two big names. Like, their faces are on the postcard. No one else's. But even the supporting cast kind of thing rocked. The two Michaels that were the henchmen. And,
yeah.
Oh, God. I love that Spencer guy.
Oh, yes. This was Ron McMillan. I had to look him up.
He was fantastic.
He was great. I mean, he just keeps popping up throughout the film. I mean, you see him right at the beginning, and as soon as pretty much the movie starts, you see him doing some chores around the house.
In full harness.
Yeah, pretty much. And I mean, he keeps popping up throughout, and he really doesn't play a very big role in the film. But
At the end,
he does.
At the end? Oh, don't worry about
it's
that.
Classic.
He's a stabber, not a shooter. Oh, my God. Classic.
Geez.
Oh,
jeez.
And that's not giving anything away. Not really.
Definitely, I'm going to have to see this movie. I can tell.
Yeah, no, it just, it has so many little nuances that I think it's a really smart script. Just the way it's set up, it sets everything up really nicely right at the beginning, and it takes its time developing the characters. Even though you don't get to know a lot about them, you get enough to sort of guide the way, and it's fairly clear who they are. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very, very good.
I love the comment in the Q&A that the director had, that it's a bunch of Albertans shooting a film about something going on in Vancouver in Winnipeg.
Yeah, that the kind of stuff that only, like, I got so excited. I'm like, holy crap, I recognize the bridge. They're actually here. Or not.
Yeah, they have one day shooting in Vancouver. Everything has to get done.
That's right. I want to mention, though, that I really think that the director, I'm going to make sure I get his name not right, Robert Cuffley, I think he shows a lot of potential here. I haven't seen his first film, though it won a bunch of West Coast Movie Awards, which totally flew under my radar a couple of years ago. But he shows a lot of restraint, too. Like the scene Colleen's talking about where she comes home and there's somebody in the house. Well, just before that, there's a scene with Lily Sobieski when she comes in. Alberta, her name is. Keep forgetting that. When she comes into the house and everything is sort of dark, and she walks into the kitchen. And any other director probably would have panned the camera to show you what was in the kitchen. And he doesn't. He just lets it happen. Which I thought was a really nice move, because it surprises the audience too. So we don't know more than the characters do. We know just what they know. And I think that really works to the film's benefit, because it keeps you interested, keeps you moving along with the story. Yeah, great fun. Great fun. So when it eventually opens in the States, it was apparently the first Canadian film to be picked up by the Weinsteins.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it'll eventually play at some point in the States, I would assume. Get some sort of theatrical release. How big? Who knows? I guess it depends on how big BSG is. I'm assuming they're going to go with the fanboys on this.
They'll wait till the new season is, like, just started.
Yeah, exactly.
A tie-in.
Pretty much. I would not be surprised. Yeah. I wouldn't put it past them to do that. But yeah, Walk All Over Me. If you're in Canada and you have a chance to see it, it's worth the trip. It's got good fun. We're going to move along to something that's been around for a couple of weeks and it's been getting a lot of buzz. And that is the Coen Brothers' No Country for Old Men.
Oh,
I told you, you needed to see the
That
movie.
Haircut will haunt me forever.
Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, help me out, Tommy Lee Jones, and I'm sure there's somebody else in there that I'm missing.
Yeah.
But
those three were the main ones. Everyone else, Woody Harrelson's in it for a short bit.
And... Well, I think by this point, everybody's pretty much knows what the movie is about, but...
So, you know what? Some of the imagery, like just the guy with the creepy hair, I forget the character's name.
Shugar
or something like that, or Shigar. Carrying around an oxygen tank and a pneumatic hammer is just brilliant. Like, this is the Coen brothers reinventing basically the wood chipper. Like I can see it coming back over and over again, and other imitators kind of thing going, yeah, let's throw someone in a wood chipper.
Yeah, I mean, who would ever imagine, you know, yeah, the killer's walking around, not with a gun, with a freaking air tank. Like, it's just the most unlikely thing you could imagine, and it totally creeped me out.
And it works so well.
Totally works. I thought it was a great film. I wouldn't mind actually seeing it a second time, but I think I'll wait for a DVD release at this point.
Yeah.
But there's some really, really memorable scenes, and I think one that keeps coming up because it is so memorable, because I think it was the one that sort of went, I went, wow, that was really, really good. When I don't think it's the first time we see Sugar, but when he stops at the gas station and he's in there when we first see the coin toss. That scene is awesome.
That's right. Well, I have to know what we're playing for.
Yeah.
You're playing for everything. But what's that? Everything.
Yeah, that scene is really, really powerful. Just the way it's edited and what they're telling you in that scene is... And it just seems so trivial. So trivial.
And it's interesting, too, because sometimes they show like the kill sort of shots quite... well, like blood splatter everywhere kind of thing, like just shirts in like soaked in blood. Other times they don't show the kill at all.
No.
Like the one time, like he walks out of the house kind of thing after killing. You never saw the kill. You didn't even hear it. He just left the building and you're left to imagine just what the hell he did.
Yeah, it's very true. Yeah. I thought actually it was kind of my favorite scene in the movie probably. So this might be a little bit of a spoiler. You might want to skip ahead a couple seconds. I'll try not to spoil it. But when they're in the hotel room just before the big shootout and he hears Josh Brolin's inside the hotel room and he hears footsteps in the hallway, that scene is awesome. The amount of tension, nothing is said. There are like no sounds other than the footsteps. And just the camera focuses on the key, the keyhole, and you know what's going to happen. And I kept thinking, aren't you going to move? Aren't you going to move? Oh my fucking God, he's not going to move. That scene was, I thought,
really, really good. I can't wait to see this. Another one. I missed so many films this last little while.
It's been busy, I know.
You know, other than probably the first time he uses the air canister and the pneumatic hammer, probably my favorites are right near the end. Shigar has a broken arm at this point kind of thing, and there's a bone sticking out of his arm, and these two kids on bikes are looking at him going, "Hey, mister, there's a bone sticking out of your arm." I just found that so funny.
Well, and
he just looks at them.
Well, and this is the thing. I think one of the reasons, I mean, when the first time I saw Fargo, I really didn't think it was all that brutal. I know. Like, it just, you watch it once. It's
not all that brutal, though.
But when you think about it, it really is extremely violent. I mean, these are violent people doing really bad things. Here, it's a little bit more obvious, but some of the moments, I mean, they're not scared by the brutality. They show you the broken bone and the blood, but it's not, it never seems over the top. It's all very realistic. Like, this could actually happen. I hope to God I never meet Shigar, because I would be running the other way. Actually, there's what's the point of running?
Absolutely no emotion there at all. It's like he was a robot.
Well, this thing, you can't even run away because you know he's going to find you. What's the point? Just deal with it already. So, I mean, this is getting a lot of awards buzz. I wouldn't be surprised if this plays well through January and well into February. If you haven't seen it yet, Dale, we'll have to drag you out for a special trip. No Country for Old Men, well worth seeing. Colleen, we're passing this one over to you. The Golden Compass.
I saw this the other day. I did a bit of a doubleheader kind of thing. And you know what? It was okay. It was beautiful. A beautiful film. Very well done. And the acting was good. Just overall, did nothing for me, really. Mm. Like, the fact that there's going to make this into a trilogy, I don't know if I'm going to need to see part two or three. So, I don't know. It had its moments kind of thing. I think the Dakota Blue Manning kind of thing did a great job.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she did really well. And for what it's worth, Daniel Craig was good, and so was what's-her-face. But, I don't know, put it all together, like, all the parts were okay to put it together? Eh.
Not so much.
Yeah. It might also have to do with the fact that I saw both that and Mr. Magorium on the same day, and it was matinees, and it was the weekend, so I was in theaters full of children, so that could have tampered my view on the universe for a while. But yeah, if you're into that kind of thing, I think you'd enjoy it. Or if you have kids, yeah, I totally take kids to it kind of thing. But
I think I'm going to wait.
Yeah.
I'm going to wait for a DVD.
It'd be good rental.
Yeah. I don't feel as much as I love the books, I'm just not feeling the pull that's saying, watch me now. So I think I might just skip it for now. Too much other stuff to see.
Yeah, I must admit, I was keen. This was pretty high on my list.
Yeah, me too.
There's too many good movies.
Yeah. No,
for sure.
Good movies. 100%. Exactly.
In the bag, good movies that I haven't seen yet. So
I know. Well,
if someone I know this Christmas wants to go see it, I'll go see it. But otherwise, maybe No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, exactly. I know exactly where you're coming from. Though I think it might be worth mentioning that It's interesting to note that we've been getting a lot of female leads in fantasy stories lately. It's not something that we see very often. In this past year, we've seen a couple already. Stardust with Claire Danes, and then Enchanted. You know, it's the princess movie, but still, mm-hmm. it's a fairly strong female lead in a fantasy film. And now, The Golden Compass.
I can't remember the year. Guillermo del Toro's.
Oh, Pan's Labyrinth.
Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, so I mean, that was last year. So it seems like there's sort of been this, I don't know if it's a changing trend, but I just happened to notice with these coming together, out together so close, I think, is maybe sort of what sparked it. But there seems to be a move kind of toward the...
Could also just be a coincidence. They're looking for fantasy novels kind of thing to make into movies, and just so happens there's a lot of decent fantasy novels with female main characters in them.
Well, and actually that's the funny thing too, because a lot of... I mean, I read a fair bit of like children's fantasy, and I hadn't really thought about it until a few minutes ago.
Okay, girls read more than boys. Little girls read way more than little boys.
That, which might be something, because I was just going to say...
If you look at the stats, women read way more books than men and make the book purchases.
All right. So our reading habits are influencing the film habits. All right. Sucks to be you guys.
Well, I think there's enough, you know, male movies out there that nobody's going to miss a couple that don't get made. But it's just an interesting
point. It is. An interesting I hadn't thought of that, yeah.
Yeah. Moving on to a classic film. Very, very classic.
Oh, extremely classic.
Yeah, this is actually what we were running out to see the last time we recorded a show. Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
I'm glad I finally got to see it.
Me too. I'm totally with you on that. I'd only ever seen bits and pieces.
Yeah, I'd seen bits and pieces, like the scene with the lady. It was interesting to see it and actually know there's a story behind it other than some just very cool, innovative sort of visuals.
Exactly.
Although the copy we saw kind of thing had just the worst sort of musical scoring to it.
The soundtrack was awful.
Yeah, I guess the version that we saw was printed by someone other than Kino. And I guess the transfer is not very good.
The transfer wasn't great, and whoever decided to do the orchestral soundtrack put a freaking CD on and just let it play.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was okay for, it seemed like, the first 20 minutes. It seemed to be in tune with the movie. And then I guess they just lost the rest of it.
So they had, like, happy, cheery during dramatic and
funeral dirges and the happy scenes.
It's just crazy, Yeah,
and while just before we recorded the show, I was mentioning that, you know, sometimes it's hard to pick up on sound in movies, like music. Sometimes it's something that I don't always pay attention to unless I really notice it for whatever reason. But in a silent film where you don't have any dialogue, it makes a huge difference. And it really does take you out of the movie. The enjoyment level really does go down a fair bit. I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't mind revisiting a good transfer.
Yeah, same
here. With the original score.
Well, I would love, this is actually one movie that I might consider a Criterion for if they ever came out with it. Because there's lots of background. The thing about this movie was, I got totally into thinking about what it must have been like to see it in that time and place.
Yeah.
And this is one of those things where if I had a DVD set with an additional hour documentary on a bunch of the history around it, I would be there. I would totally be there.
Yeah. Well, when was that actually made? Like
1927.
27.
Yeah.
So that's about 10 years after the Russian Revolution and like World War I. Yeah, it's interesting when you think history, like Leninism and all that kind of thing. Like, there's a lot of...
You could see that in there, too. They were playing with those ideas.
It's an interesting film, for sure. Now, there isn't a Criterion edition that I know of, but Kino does have a version they just released recently, fully restored with the original 1927 soundtrack.
I would watch it again for the original soundtrack.
Yeah, and absolutely. It's actually one that I might pick up because it's fairly inexpensive.
Is it the kind of film that, like, you should probably at least see once kind of thing? Like, one of those odd ones that...
Not only if you're... I mean, if you're a history buff or you like film, I would say yes. But I wouldn't say this is a film for just anybody.
That's who I was talking about. The rest of the people are irrelevant.
Never mind.
You're not a film buff? Who needs you? Go away.
But I mean, even for just like the mediocre film aficionado, I think it's. I think the rewatch value is quite good if you have a good print. For me, I would watch it more than another time. It wouldn't faze me to throw it in, just for the sake of watching it. But for me, it would really have to be a good print because I would not watch the print that I saw again.
Yeah, well, let's watch the Kino and
And decide. But yeah, it's one that we may have to revisit at some point in the future. Oh, Donkey Kong rules.
The King of Kong, a fistful of quarters.
You know, I was saying yesterday when I booked this movie, I try not to book bad movies, but sometimes it happens. And I knew it was good. Like, I'd read enough stuff that I knew it was a good movie. Didn't realize it was a really, really, really good movie.
Well, when you think about it, the premise, like, if you haven't heard anything about it, it's about some laid-off engineer guy from Redmond, Washington, who is basically trying to beat the world record that's been around for, like, 20-odd years, on Donkey Kong.
25 years. Like, now, 1982, yeah. It was set.
I never thought you guys could, like, make me feel sorry for, like, going to a Christmas party and getting presents and missing a movie. But I am, like, really bummed out that I missed this movie.
Because it's really, really good.
It's, I mean, okay, folks, these two have been talking about hardly anything else except things out of this movie.
Kneel down before Zod.
Yeah, you know, the whole time I was thinking, you know, he looks familiar. And then there's a scene where he's getting, like, prepared to go out to the big contest that's going on. And you sort of see him through the crack of this door. And he's brushing his hair. And I turned to Colleen and I said, kneel before Zod. And we couldn't stop laughing. It was perfect. It's not quite as funny when you haven't seen the picture.
I lost it.
Yeah, it's... I think what really, really works for this movie is the fact that it's a really good story. A really good story.
That's the thing. Like, if you were to write a story, you have someone you, like, empathize with, and you have the villain, and you have betrayals and double cross and adversities that you have to get over. And this thing plays better than most films I've seen. Like, you have all the elements there for a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
Which, oddly enough, it sounds like he's trying to make a fictional movie of the events, too. But
yeah, and apparently they're trying to go with what happened after the documentary, which is really what, at this point, I'm actually more interested. Now that I've enjoyed the documentary and I know how good it is, and I better believe I'm going to be buying this DVD when it comes out, because I want to see if there's anything more that they give us, because I'm really curious about, because all of the movie's really weird, because it sort of looks like, and somebody in the comments to the review mentioned that they weren't sure if this was a new documentary or an old documentary, because it uses a lot of stock footage from the 1982
World Ultimate Gamer Challenge or something like that.
Yeah, that Time Magazine did. And so a lot of the footage is original from that. And a lot of it, the rest of it is all like 3 years of filming. But you can tell it wasn't, like, it's not a project that had a lot of money. Like, some of the footage is kind of grainy and, you know, I don't know. Like, I'm curious to see how they compiled all of this data and how it was edited together. Because I'm really concerned that maybe we're not getting the whole Mitchell story.
Well, you know what?
I can't believe I'm concerned about a guy who has Donkey Kong world record.
I don't doubt Mitchell. You can't say or act like that without being a complete and utter prick. I'm more interested about just how sugar-coated they made Steve Wiebe's
story. But I think Wiebe, he doesn't always come across as, you know, soft guy. I mean,
First time he's beating the record and
his kid is yelling in the background. He's like, Dad, no, Donkey Kong. and he's not looking there. He's like, I am concentrating on this. I am doing nothing else. And you think, okay, that's some really bad parenting. But you know, everybody has a vice, and if your worst vice is playing video games, good God, so be it. But I mean, yeah, he's not, he doesn't come across as like this, you know, oh yeah, I have no faults, but he does come across as the nicer of the two.
Oh,
and I mean,
way nicer.
Mitchell, right off the bat, comes across as a bit of a dick.
Well, Steve, we be there. Like, a couple times in the film, you can see just tears rolling down his face from dealing with people who are not necessarily good people. Mm-hmm. Or at least portrayed that way. And, like, the things that happen that they film kind of thing, even if they are not like that normally, they were like that
when
at that time, like some of the betrayal, you wouldn't think there'd be much nasty sort of backstabbing betrayal sort of thing in the sort of console classic video game world, but holy crap.
I mean, you couldn't have written some of these characters better.
Oh,
I mean, there's some really creepy dudes in this place.
They all were.
Yeah, generally.
Like, they all were just weird as hell. Like, Steve Wiebe looked sane. And, like, this is a guy who dedicated his life to Donkey Kong. Oh, like, the Robert Mitchell guy going into, like, grocery stores, pushing all the other sort of, like, chicken wing sauces out of the way so he could put his own personal brand out front so he could take up a whole aisle. Like,
you know, I had a thought this morning. My brother-in-law lives near Hollywood, California, Hollywood, Florida. I'm actually thinking maybe I should get him to go into this fun spot, whatever it is.
Can you take a picture of?
Yeah, exactly. Can you track down this? Because he's got that restaurant, right? Like, could you go in there and like smack the guy across the back of the head for me? Here, send him my condolences. No, I don't know. It's, you know, who knew Donkey Kong could be so interesting?
Was it all the other gamers, like the final sort of like showdown kind of thing, which Robert Mitchell never did play at kind of thing? They all decide to go out and have a meal together. All these ultimate gamers, except for
and you don't invite Steve Wiebe kind of thing. The live record.
Yeah,
it's just childish.
And then when he shows up, they're on the phone. It's like, yeah, man, he's here. We didn't invite him. Yeah, man. Yeah. He's completely uninvited and came here. It's a freaking public restaurant.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's, I don't know. It's like the most trivial of things, and it creates some of the most, that's always the case, right? The most trivial always creates the most entertaining.
Well, and when people get passionate about things, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, to not be, because I don't consider myself a gamer or a classic gamer at that, even though I love Tetris. Tetris is my vice.
Zaxxon.
But, you know, you really, the filmmaker has created a really great film that encourages the passion from its fans. And I mean, people couldn't, I mean, when Wiebe actually beat the record, like towards the end of the film, they show you, they don't actually show it happening because I guess by that point they probably finished filming already. But you sort of see, you get this graph where you have Mitchell's score and then you got the little line graph going up and we're like, oh my God, he's getting closer. And you can see everybody
as soon as he passed.
Yeah! Like round of applause, big cheer. But you can see people like leaning in.
They because Robert Mitchell was the villain. You did not want, and normally I do root for the bad guy. I will admit that, but not this bad guy. There was nothing cool about this bad guy. There was nothing glamorous about this bad guy. You just wanted him to have his ass kicked.
I have a feeling we're never going to get an invite to his restaurant.
No. And you know what? I have a funny feeling he's dealing with a lot of backlash.
Yeah.
Because if you see this film kind of thing, everyone involved, other than Steve Wiebe kind of thing, comes across as a complete ass. Yeah.
So there are some, I am sort of kind of curious to see
what the editing was.
Do you know anything about the director?
He's directed a film, a feature film. I think this is his first documentary.
Okay. Is he primarily a documentary? Or
like, no, he's only made like two or three movies.
Can we expect more from him is what I'm wondering.
Yeah, he's, well, his next project is
the film version, isn't it?
No, but he's working on something else before then. If you guys keep talking for a minute, I can
No, I just can't get over what a good story it was. And this is a documentary, but it played out better than most movies I've seen this year.
If the last 2 years haven't shown that documentaries aren't interesting, then
well, you know what? Documentaries can be interesting, but how often are they truly entertaining?
Yeah, well, I mean, let's face it. Real life stories you usually have to manipulate into a story structure to make it interesting. So,
well, he's got Four Christmases, which he's filming right now. And if I'm not mistaken, that has a whole bunch of actors in it. It is a feature film. And then after that, I believe his next project is, he was talking about I was reading on the film's website that he's working on a feature adaptation of the story, but he's trying to lead it towards, he doesn't want to redo the same story. He wants to sort of, after the documentary, this is what happened kind of thing.
I'd be worried about that, because how could you get anyone to play these characters?
Well, especially once you've seen them, I think it would be really difficult to try to find somebody that would fit the part. Though I think Captain Tight Pants is like ready to go, man.
Oh, for Steve Wiebe? Yeah. But I wasn't worried about Steve Wiebe's character kind of thing, but like the villains, like that.
Give it to Philip Seymour.
The guy who was trying to get the.
Okay, I got
to
see this.
The guy who was trying to get the next kill screen, the Bill Coup or something like that.
Oh, that guy.
What a tool. He's like on the phone every like 2 minutes to like
holy shit.
Okay, Richard, you like the film.
Yeah, I think we better move on.
Fantastic. Yeah,
I mean, it comes out on DVD January 29th.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
So they're isn't long.
Still in our local theater.
For like 2 more days.
You should make a pilgrimage. Okay. Yeah.
But it'll be okay if you wait until the end of January, I think.
No, it won't.
We're going to have t-shirts made. What was it?
I'm thinking Steve Wiebe. Steve Wiebe is my hero, and then have Donkey Kong and then his score. And then possibly below it, something like Richard, can lick or something like that. I don't know. I haven't worked it out yet. It'll be on my Cafe Press show, store for sure.
Oh, and we're going to finish off with something that is equally as entertaining. Fido, finally. Finally, they see Fido.
Quality.
For those of you that, most of you who probably didn't get a chance to see it in the theater, it's out on DVD.
Yep.
Zombies as pets. Awesome.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I guess I should have set that up. I totally missed that. 1950s style.
It's kind of a setting.
Yeah.
Alternate Earth. There's been radiation and dead people come back to life as zombies. But
Zomcom, a quality company, has developed a harness for their impulses. And now they can be trained to do menial tasks and become pets.
You gotta love that, a zombie pet. And everyone has to have at least one.
That's right.
Our neighbor has six. What was I supposed to do? So I said we have one.
Now you just have to go find the one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Billy Connolly as Fido.
As Fido.
With the whole grunting bit. I think he really did a good job with that. It's been a while since I've seen it, but...
Carrie Ann Moss.
Carrie Ann Moss, yes. She's a very different role from... The Matrix.
Oh, indeed. Though she's still
Doris Day mother kind of thing.
Kind of, pretty much. But she's still the strong mom.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you find out.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah.
But it's a very subversive film. If you like films that have a story underneath that it's... God, I can't think of the literary term right now for allegory. Anyway, there's
how about allegory?
This is very much a social commentary as well as being just a really whack funny film.
Yeah.
It's actually a little bit strange, creepy in places, but I still enjoyed it.
The neighbor.
Oh, the neighbor with the girlfriend zombie?
Yeah, that was just a little bit.
No teeth.
Yeah.
Strange.
Really funny. But then
that's what I meant by subversive kind of. Definitely you can see some jabs at society. And
some of the
norms
stuff
in there.
Kids' outdoor education was actually rifle work.
Yeah.
What was it? The father gives the kid
a handgun.
Go. I know you're not supposed to have a handgun until you're 12, but
yeah,
I think it's time. Just don't flash it around at school. Like all the other kids have rifles. I have a handgun.
It's a fun movie, and I think it's a great first film for director Andrew Curry.
Is that his first?
Yeah, I believe it's his first film.
Nice.
Good Canadian boy filming in BC in the outback of British Columbia.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really surprised when they scored Billy Connolly for that.
Well, they have a really good cast
involved. Yeah, one other actor from Two and a Half Men played the father.
Oh.
Yeah, not Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, I'm not going to remember his name.
The other one. The one that's kind of like Matthew Broderick, but isn't.
Kind of like Matthew Broderick, but isn't.
He always reminds me of him. I don't know why. But yeah, that film, while Marina's looking for it quickly.
yeah, you should run down the actors.
This has pretty much made up my mind what I'm going for Halloween next year. I'm going to go as a Zombie-com scout. That's right. Instead of Boy Scouts, it's the Zomcom scouting group.
So we have, it's Dylan Baker that you guys are.
Nice.
And who played the neighbor?
Tim Blake Nelson.
Yeah.
Which to me is, for me, it was the best part of
that
movie.
The ultimate subverted authority figure, this guy. Yeah. That was great. Zombie war hero.
Is there anybody else? I think that's pretty much the big three names. But the fact that they got Tim Blake Nelson and Billy Connolly involved. I mean, Carrie-Anne Moss, I think, is really into the whole Canadian film scene. She's made a couple of smaller Canadian films, but it's always nice to be able to score, you know, a big Hollywood name that brings some recognition to your film.
And the thing that really struck me about this was just how well they did at recreating the 50s, but it wasn't our 50s.
It was their own sort of version of
the 1950s. And it was really, it was almost the 50s from some of the television shows, like, only in a hyper kind of reality kind of a sense.
Leave It to Beaver meets Zombies was
Leave It to Beaver in color, but turned up a couple notches. Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
That was sort of what everybody equated it to. But yeah, good little fun movie.
Yeah, if you're just looking for something to have a good laugh, this is it.
Fido. Add it to your zombie collection.
Oh, it will be in my zombie collection. Although, if you are a hardcore zombie fan, yeah, you know what? You'll want to see it because it's zombies. But you know what? They're not the killing sort of like a rampaging nastiness because they are harnessed, which is kind of sad.
The ones out in the wilderness,
the wild ones. But we don't get to focus on them much. It's all about the
but this is
domesticated.
This is it though. There was that whole allusion to atomic power because it's harnessed, but it can still bite you in the ass if you turn the wrong way.
That's so very true. So yeah, Fido, if you have a chance to go to your local video store, I'm sure everybody carries it. It's fabulous. I didn't add it to the list, but we just finished watching West Bank Story. And I think we need to mention it just because Colleen's already drawing a blank.
Yes. I didn't realize that was the actual name of that gem we saw earlier.
I tracked down a copy of last year's live action Oscar short, the musical greatness that is West Bank Story. And wow.
A West Side Story set in, I guess, the Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Close enough.
Yeah, shiny. Exactly.
Israelis and Palestinians in close proximity.
Yeah. And I mean,
sharing falafels.
And it plays to all of the stereotypes.
The kosher king versus the hummus hut.
Yeah, hummus hut. It plays all the stereotypes. They're all there. And none of them feel like, I don't know, none of it really, I mean, it didn't, what's the word I'm looking for? Mind you, I'm neither Jewish nor Muslim, but I didn't feel offended. I didn't think it was offensive.
It didn't have a mean spirit to it.
No, it didn't.
It really looked like it was, you know,
they were enjoying
just having
themselves.
Fun with everything.
Yeah, but I mean, I think they really hit it. Like, and then they showed you that these are people are the same.
In the musical number where the main actress is singing, I mean, the voice that could have come out of any Disney cartoon. I mean, I heard Ariel and Sleeping Beauty. And
I'm thinking Beauty and the Beast.
You know, my favorite part, though, is the same girl kind thing. She's at the till and the person's coming up.
Don't spoil it.
Oh, my God.
Hilarious.
That's why I didn't see anything.
The opening with her at the till.
Find it, download it, watch it. Tell me what you think, please.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a chance, it's well worth seeing. And I think Colleen and I were discussing how, you know, this would be, you said something about Shaun of the Dead.
Oh, there's a scene where the Israelis and the Palestinians are sort of like walking in single file. And you see them both sort of like scoot past the camera. And they're sort of like Shaun of the Dead had a scene where Shaun and his people pass, I think it's Jen or Jill, his friend. And they're going to the Air Force base or something like that. And every single one of them meets and says hello. And they all are sort of like exactly the same, except for different. Yeah. So like both moms are sort of very similar to each other, but very different at the same time. Same sort of thing. The stereotypes kind of thing, side by side. You know, it was brilliant.
I mean, this is really like Oscar gave Shaun of the Dead an Oscar. Like, if that were to happen, this would be it.
Like I say, like the Oscars take themselves way too seriously in some ways. That's why a comedy will never win Best Picture, or I don't think one's ever done it. Anyways, it's all about the big sort of categories, actor, actress kind of thing, movie, director. They don't have a sense of humor there. But you know what? The smaller things like animated and shorts and things like that, they can let go sometimes and pick the right one.
I think this
was really a good choice.
Oh,
yeah, totally quality. Agree. So
I couldn't look away.
Yeah, if you have a chance to see it, I'll actually post a link to the version that I saw. Because it's online, people can find it. It's not that difficult. So you can, if you have the time, you can enjoy the greatness that is West Bank Story, because it is quite great. That's our show for today, I think. Make sure you come by row3.com and leave your comments and check out the other news stories. It's a very busy site, we've discovered. Lots of stuff happens every day, so visit often. Visit lots, leave lots of comments. And I think we'll talk next week.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.